Hello, my name is Brad McIntyre, and you're listening to the Cultivated Playwright Podcast. This is episode 37. Welcome back. This is going to be the second part of my rather extensive interview with Mr. David Hopkins, a fantasy writer and indie author. In the first part of the interview, which was the previous episode, which if you haven't listened to, I recommend you go back and do so. We talk about kind of how he came up and kind of learned what he wanted to do. How he came up as a writer doing comics and journalism. He was a teacher. He did some biography. He had an unsuccessful foray into playwriting. Anyway, in this particular part of the interview, we kind of bring it closer to recent times and what he is working on, what his contemporary projects are, including a very large project that he's doing called The Dryad's Crown. The Dryad's Crown is destined to be a 700-page-plus epic fantasy novel that he is releasing at the end of the summer, like as a massive tome. But he's been releasing it in installments, in increments, in a sort of a serialized fashion as novellas over the last, some months now, maybe a year and a half, perhaps 2 years. Anyway, it's a 9 novella series that he has been releasing as ebooks. And then at the end of the summer, these will culminate into a massive, huge, epic fantasy book. Anyway, we talk about this fantasy book. We also talk about how David has basically put him an artist foundation under himself, a platform for reaching his audience and marketing his books as an indie author. And I have to be honest, this is what is the most interesting thing to me, because this is the stuff that I am trying to figure out as an independent artist, as an indie playwright, how to reach my audiences, how to reach my readers, and so on. So we talk about learning what your target audience is and how to work with collaborators. And we talk about why David doesn't do book trailers. So we don't get in the weeds as much as I probably would have preferred. But we do talk a lot about, you know, Patreon and website design and Facebook ads and things like that. So I don't know. If you're into that kind of thing of like trying to reach an audience as an independent operator, maybe you can glean some stuff from this particular episode. But anyway, buckle in and hope you enjoy. I'll pop back in at the end to do the outro.
All right, part two. So, I want to say several years ago, but it might have been almost a decade now. I kind of watched you pivot from one kind of artist into another kind of artist. And the reason I kind of wanted to have this podcast was I've been observing somebody basically take the baton and run with it in a certain direction. And you did a bunch of things, a lot of small things that add up. Like you kind of revamped your website. You put together a newsletter and paying attention to the David Hopkins brand. Like you got your own little signature.
Yes.
decal. You even started referring to yourself as a fantasy writer instead of a writer of speculative fiction. Mm-hmm. Like you changed how you talked about yourself. And so what I want to do is just kind of unpack that journey. What it seemed like is that you were floating around for a long time, trying a bunch of different things. And then there was a point where you're like, this is the path, like, or this is the direction I want to be heading in. And then you started heading in that very clear kind of route. Tell me about kind of the decision process to do that.
Totally. And I'm actually, it's a good question to ask, because I think you're absolutely spot on. Is I was doing a lot of different things and I was figuring out a lot of things. But one of the things that took me a really long time to figure out was, so often as creatives, we have like friends and family who follow us and support us because they're our friends or they're our family. And you cultivate this group of friends, and it can be wonderfully supportive and encouraging and validating. But what you realize is there's a whole world out there of people that might enjoy your stuff, but if you keep hopping around, they never figure out who you are. And so it's not just like, oh, I mean, there are a few people out there, I think, who their brand is so solid that like Neil Gaiman could do anything at this point and it would do well because his fans just believe in him and he's proven himself. But like if I'm working on this and then I go over, even with comics, every different project, it was a different genre. It was a different tone. It was a different style of art. I mean, it was all very different. And so it was not fair to the people that liked something I had done previously, because then they jump over to the new thing and they go, oh, this isn't the same thing. You know, there are certain comic book writers who you just know their audience so well. Like the people who like this story, this is who they are. And I think that there's something that we don't always talk about in writing class. Like we don't always talk about, you know, all right, kids, you got to figure out your brand so that you can keep your audience and all this stuff. But I did realize, I was like, I'm all over the place. And while it's fun for me, it's not really fair. And so what I started doing was really taking a step back and going, okay, who do I want to be as a writer? Where do I kind of want to focus my work? And it wasn't in comics. It was definitely in writing novels and writing long form works. And it was epic fantasy that I wanted to write. And that was a thing where I was like, okay, if I'm going to do this, then I really need to pay attention to the people who are also doing it. What kind of words are they using to describe themselves and their work? What are the things that, you know, are on their website? What are the things that they really rely on from a social media standpoint? And so I really began to get, the word is intentional. I got more intentional about trying to find my people. And, you know, the worst thing I could do right now is like, write a romance set in Victorian era, like, because all of a sudden it's like you take all the stuff you build up and you go, and I'm going over here. So that was really why I did it, was because I was like, I feel like I've learned a lot as a writer, but the one thing there was a hard lesson for me is that you really do have to build a brand if you want to have an audience.
When I talk to students about playwriting, and I sometimes do playwriting workshops, I have to emphasize that they have to show the plays to an audience eventually. Like somebody has to watch it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it doesn't work. But plays in particular, because they're just blueprints. They're like recipes that nobody's cooked yet. But I have to emphasize, I'm like, listen, everything that you're doing is for the audience. The viewer of this piece is the most important and only really important part of this whole endeavor. And if you don't write it with them in mind, it's not going to work. And I imagine as a writer of fiction, you definitely keep the reader in mind. And you're an excellent storyteller. I got to tell you, as I've been following you, you know, over the years, and I'll be honest, I'm not the target demographic for the Dryad's Crown. I had to look up what a dryad was. David, I literally had to go online and like, what did he make this word up? This sounds like a vaguely familiar word that I should know. And then I was like, oh, a wood nymph. Okay. No. That's a thing. Like that's a thing. And I've read the first book and I'm planning to get the other ones, but I have to admit I'm not a fantasy. I don't read fantasy as a regular thing. I'm not your target audience. I'm a David Hopkins fan.
Yeah.
More than a fantasy fan.
Well, you fall into that first group.
Catches us both.
Yeah.
Yeah. But as I'm reading it, I know enough about fantasy to know that I was like, oh, he is also a student of fantasy fiction. He knows what the tropes are. He knows how to build a world. And for me personally, I was like, oh my gosh, he's like really good at telling a story. Like, you're a very good storyteller. Yeah, I enjoyed the first book immensely. I have plans. I have the second and third one on my Kindle. I have not got to them yet. But yet is the appropriate word. Yet.
Yeah, and I've finished all 9 novellas. I've written them, so it is, it's done. It's just got to release them now.
Okay. Yeah, you've got 6 of them out so far.
6 of them are available right now, and 7, 8, and 9 have been written. I just need to edit and get it packaged, and it'll all be out by around March, I think.
And then next September is when you're releasing the giant
paperback
volume.
Yeah. Paperback.
Okay. I want to come back to that in a second. What have been kind of the, the highlights and also like some pitfalls of going this direction? And I don't mind if you get in the weeds a little bit here about how you came up with your Patreon account, how you figured out what you wanted to focus on when putting together your website, where you got the idea to put together a newsletter, like that kind of thing.
Yeah. And honestly, glad you started with Patreon, because I could not do what I've done without Patreon. And for those who don't know, Patreon it basically allows you to support creatives, makers, musicians, all sorts of people with monthly small, what I would consider micro payments. So let's say I've got a favorite writer that I like, and I want to give them $2 a month. And those $2, when you add it all up with all the people supporting them, gives them enough money so that they can do the thing that they want to do, you know. And that's, Patreon is a wonderful thing. I spent quite a while watching videos from the CEO of Patreon, who just does a really good job explaining how you do it. He's like an encourager. He's definitely a coach, a cheerleader. And so you're like, yeah, I could totally do this. And but what it enabled me to do was, first of all, in my own opinion, Patreon does not work if it's a small project. You've got to be ambitious. So if you're like, all right, you guys are going to support me, and by the end of the year, I will have a poem. It will be 5 lines long, and it will be a wonderful poem. Like, you can't do that. Like, it's got to be like, this is the thing that I've been wanting to do my whole life, and the only way I'm going to get it done is with your support, you know? And so that was a kind of thing where I was like, Dryad's Crown, we're going to go big with this. This is going to be, because I know fantasy readers like big, chunky books, like The Doorstop, you know, Used as a Weapon. Like, those are the kind of books fantasy readers like. So it's like, I need to write a big novel. And so, yeah, the novel, when it's all finished, will be around 700 pages, which, I don't know, that's a big novel for me.
That's hefty.
But it was also like, okay, we're going to also make it illustrated, and we're going to get a professional editor to read through everything. And so we start adding on some expenses to let the patrons know what they're supporting. And that's, you give them regular updates, kind of let them know how it's going. You keep thanking them. You give them perks where you can. And that's what I've been trying to do. In fact, I have to write some postcards to thank my patrons. I usually do it at the end of the year. I'll write a postcard to all of them and be like, hey, thanks for doing what you do. And I send those off. But yeah, so you got to get big and ambitious. But I mean, what that means is every month I get a direct deposit from Patreon into my checking account. And that allows me to justify paying an illustrator, paying an editor, because you're married like I'm married. And it's a hard conversation to be like, all right, love, we're going to throw down hundreds of dollars on a thing that's going to take several years, and it may not make a profit. So are you with me? And, you know, that's a hard ask. So Patreon allows me to cover some of those expenses so that I can kind of do it the right way, not half-ass it, but whole-ass the project. And working with an editor has been great, because it allows me to get like meaningful feedback as I'm working on this, really get that. People pushing back on me and being like, you know, the funny thing was, and this is a whole other conversation, but the editor I got, I've I've made sure to surround myself with a lot of women who are very intelligent and just awesome. But part of it is because I'm writing from a woman's viewpoint in the story. And I was like, I need women in my life who can give me feedback. So if something doesn't ring true, if something feels off, they can tell me that. And also, you know, just some wonderful, wonderful people. And the funny thing was, in book three, I wrote a particularly violent scene that I kind of cheated out. We faded away to another scene so that you didn't actually see the violence. The violence was implied. You don't actually see it. And I felt like that was a fitting way to go. And the editor, you know, who, once again, the cliche is that, you know, boys like violence and blood and women like Bridgerton, you know. And it's so funny because Holly, my editor, was like, you cut away from this scene and I absolutely want to see this person get their head cut off. And so she was really like telling me, you need to make this more violent. You need to make this, like, you really need to lean into it. And I was like, but my delicate sensibilities. And she's like, no. You need to commit to this because you've brought us here. Now's the time to get gory. And it is so funny because we bring such assumptions to it. And yeah, working with her has been wonderful because she pushes me in ways that I need to be pushed. That doesn't happen without Patreon. And then the other thing is, as you start following other writers, you start learning things like, and this is pivoting back to the newsletter, I've been reading different marketing books on marketing for creatives. And by and large, people think that email is dead, but newsletters still have the highest return of anything that you could do. More than Twitter, more than Facebook, more than, I mean, I would say the only thing that probably gets you a better return is content like doing a podcast or doing like a YouTube series. Like if you're making long form content that kind of promotes your other content, that's really, really great. It's a lot of sweat equity to make that stuff happen. But second to that,
I haven't seen it yet, David.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. It's a rumor.
Yeah. But newsletters are wonderful, and there are ways to build newsletters by like doing giveaways and working with other writers where you're like doing contests where it's like, okay, we're going to collect email addresses for the newsletter and we're going to pick five people who are going to win these books. And you do ways to build the newsletter. Or I reworked an older, I kind of edited and re-released an early public domain novel called The Princess and the Goblin. And people who want to download that book have to sign up for my newsletter. So there's little incentives to get more people. And, you know, it's taken me a while, but I've got around, and this is, I know some people who have really large newsletter groups, but I have about 2,400 subscribers right now. And yeah, that took me a long time to build that group. I would say on a good day, I'll get about 30% of them opening the email and I'll get about 10% of them clicking on whatever it is that I put in the email. So even when you get that number, it still kind of funnels down to a very few group of people.
That's a couple of hundred people, like still. Like, yeah. So.
And it is by and large, like if I have a new book come out, that is the thing that will get me more sales than anything else. Like I can always guarantee if I send out a newsletter saying that the book is out, I can almost guarantee I'm going to sell 50 copies of the book. Which is okay. Is great when you get to that point to where you can just be like, I know that if I do this thing, this number of people are going to show up for it.
Hey, I was going to ask you about your team. Since you mentioned it, we can circle back to the marketing stuff here in a second. But
I'm all over the place.
You have an editor. Do you have a proofreader and an illustrator? Is there anybody else I'm missing? Who's in your team? Who are your collaborators when you're putting together the books?
Yeah, for the book, I have a developmental editor. That is Holly Lynn Walrath. And she's wonderful. One of the things that I really depend on her for is she works in fantasy. So she understands the genre, she understands the audience, and she reads through it, gives me notes, feedback. Her changes are usually like the big changes, like this scene would work better here. Consider the character going more in this direction. Or, and she's, you know, the great thing is an editor only improves with time. Like the more you work with the editor, the better the quality of the collaboration gets. And so, you know, it's one of those things where it's like,
get to know each other. You guys get to know each other. She gets to know your work and how you think, and you get to know what she's thinking. And okay.
Yeah. And that's a wonderful thing. So it's like, okay, you know, we're doing a 9-book novella series, and it's like, she hopped on actually with book 3 because I had a different developmental editor for book 1. She disappeared, and then Holly and I just really clicked. And, you know, by the time we get to that 7th, 8th
book. Was she recommended to you?
Yes. My friend Bonnie Stuffelbeam, who is also a writer, I emailed her and I said, Bonnie, I need an editor. Who would you recommend? And she gave me a list and she said, Holly would be the person I'd pick. Holly's my best friend. I love her. She's great. And so I emailed Holly just to get a feel for kind of her approach. And her approach to editing very much connected with my approach, which is, I don't want to be reductive, but so many times I hear people talk about how they want an editor that's just brutal. I want an editor just to tear me apart. And I'm like, I don't want that at all. I don't need someone to be brutal with me because the reader is not brutal. Anyone who picks up your book or anyone who goes to a play, they want to enjoy what they're watching or what they're reading. They're not there to go, okay, prove to me that what I'm doing is worth, you know, they go there with expectation and they want to feel something. And so
yeah, they want it to be good. Yeah.
So I want my editor to approach my work the same way a fan of the genre would approach the work, because I don't need her to tell me that all my stuff is crap, because that's me in the first draft anyways. Like, I'm already kicking myself. I don't need someone else to kick me even more. Like, and so I love her blend of, she is able to encourage, to challenge, to motivate, without it being this sort of weird, like, I don't know, flagellation, where it's just like, I'm just whipping myself because I'm an artist and my role in life is to suffer. Like, I think that she brings a level of encouragement that I just absolutely love. And then I do have a proofreader, my friend Kara. She is at the very end of the assembly line, and that's absolutely essential to catch all or most of the stupid little mistakes that I make. I also have an illustrator who, he does not really help me with the writing, because usually he's coming after I've written it and I'm telling him, okay, I need you to draw this and this. But his contributions are so fundamental to the book, because I don't know about you, but one of the things I really loved about fantasy books is when they had illustrations in them. Like, I loved picking up the Dark Tower series by Stephen King, and there would be these really great full-page illustrations in there. Like, and it would be like every 100 or 200 pages. It was like a little reward, a little treat to the reader. Be like, you made it this far. Have an illustration. and it adds so much, because now with those illustrations, I mean, Daniel DeSena, who is the illustrator, and he's just been so excited about the process. Like, this is the thing that he wants to do. He wants to illustrate novels. And so he's like, yeah, I'm totally game for this. And by illustrating it, you're sort of shaping the way that the audience is going to see the characters too. You know, they may fight you a little bit, but it's hard when that picture is staring back at you and go, okay, yeah, that's what the main characters look like. So, and then I've got a designer who's designed the cover. I have an artist who created the art for the cover. The biggest collaborator that I haven't worked with yet is I have the audiobook narrator who, even though, I mean, so many people are going to experience the book through her words. And so the way that she reads it, how she reads it, the inflection that she adds to it, the way she interprets the material, the way she performs it, because her name's Lindsay Dorcas. She is a audiobook narrator from Chicago. She has a theater background. I mean, her choices become the way that all of those audiobook listeners, how they're going to hear it. And so, yeah, I mean, in many ways, she is one of the most important collaborators that I have.
That's fantastic. Yeah, the illustrations are fantastic. Like, I have to say,
they're really good.
But it strikes me that you're the prime motivator. Like, you're the instigator of the whole process. Yeah. You're the creator of it, but you're not a complete one-man band. You have a team. You're working with a team. Do you ever read your stuff out loud?
Yes.
Before you do you submit April to listening to stuff?
Well, April actually reads my, like, there are a lot of wives and husbands and spouses of writers who will not read their spouse's work. April actually is my first reader. Like, even before it gets to Holly, I'll have April just give it a read through. And so I don't read it to her. She reads it herself, and I leave her alone while she's reading it. And then afterwards, we'll usually, probably around breakfast time, over a cup of coffee, we'll talk about the book a little bit. And her insight is invaluable because she is not a fantasy reader. She's not into fantasy. And so it's interesting to have someone who's not used to the tropes, not used to all the shorthand. And she's like, okay, now why is this here? And it makes me realize, oh, I assumed something, because that's just, I'm so in it that I forgot that this is a thing that I probably need to unpack. For instance, she was reading book 8. And I talk about the Feywild and this world of fairy, you know, where the Fey court is. And she's like, so where is this place? Like, what is it in relationship to the, like, you know? And it's that thing like, oh, can you sail there? What is this, another dimension? What are we talking about when we talk about other dimensions? Like, fans talk about that stuff as if it's just a given. And that's not something that your average reader is just going to be like, oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I will admit I had to do a crash course on Fey and fairy stuff. And as I said, I had to look up what a dryad was. But then I was like, oh, and I see it's just the terminology for a concept that I already knew. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know the terminology. I do that with Ruth as well, because theater is such a verbal media, I read out loud to her scenes of my plays. If I left it for her to read, she would never read it. She would never read it. But I will sometimes, like, come here, listen to this, and I'll read her a scene out loud, and it's good for me to hear it out loud. I also, literally reading it off the screen as I'm doing it, I can catch all the spelling mistakes and mm-hmm. all the half-baked thoughts that are not full sentences or not full thoughts, you know, on the paper. I found that reading stuff out loud is, for my purposes, is like really beneficial. And I was just wondering if April, if you laid your wife listening to you, but she's a pretty voracious reader on her own, though, isn't she? Like, yeah, April reads a lot.
Yeah, she reads more than I do, which I guess I'm not supposed to say. But we're different types of readers, though. She is a person, if she reads 50 pages into it and she's not feeling the book, she tosses it and grabs another one. And that actually makes her read faster because she's only going to read things that she's excited about. Whereas me, I feel like this urge to, like, finish it. Even if I'm not really getting into it, I will, like, tough it out. And so as a result, I tend to read slower because I'm like, ugh, this part is so tedious. But I've committed. I started the book. I'm going to finish it. And so, yeah, we'd have different philosophies, but at the end of the day, she reads more than I do, in part because she doesn't feel the need to be charitable with her time. Like, she's like, if I don't like it, I'm going, I'm gone. And that's great. It's also really fun having her read this stuff because, just like you said, when you start reading things aloud, as I'm kind of reading it or sharing it, sometimes, not always, but sometimes you'll get this pit in your stomach where you're like, oh, this is dumb. And you're like, and not dumb like as in like I have a low self-esteem, but you can realize when something's not working and you go, oh, okay, no, I'm going to redo this part. And that helps. Like, case in point, I was writing a very spicy little romance scene in book 7. And once I shared it with April, she was like, yeah, this one does not work at all. And I was, and she usually is pretty kind with her feedback, but this time she was like, this one didn't work. And so she like took out like whole sections, and then, and she was like, you got too much of this, too much of that. And I was like, oh yeah, absolutely right. But it was one of those things where in my head on the first write, I was like, oh, this is like so working. And then once you share it, you're like, no, it's not. Abort. And I'm sure you get that when you've got people on the stage and you're like, oh, I want to rework this.
Oh, yeah. I'm very keyed into, is this working? Is this working right now? Is this working in the context of everything around it? Oh, fix it. Oh, fix it. the thing kind of jumps up at me. As I said, I wanted to kind of segue back around, though. You said you got into marketing. Yeah. After kind of your sojourn into journalism, you work for marketing. You have like a part-time day job or full-time day job? Like,
it is.
You work in marketing now.
Yeah. I work from home Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and then Tuesday, Thursday, I'm in the office, and I am a copywriter for a marketing agency that will go unnamed, but they're wonderful, and I love them, but. Yeah, I've been doing that for about 10 years now. Ups and downs. It took me a while to really figure out what was going on and to find an agency that I liked and that worked well for me and that I worked well for them. And it's been great. But the funny thing is I've met along the way, I've got another friend who is a sci-fi writer who also works in marketing. And we often joke about the fact that the advice we give to our clients is not always the advice that we ourselves take. Like where we're like, you need to do this, you need to do that. And then in the end, you're like, I don't want to do it. And it is funny. It's that sort of doctor heal thyself, you know. And I will say, though, I think there are some people who are just naturally very good at marketing their work, like creatively. They're good in a room is the expression. You know, they can talk about their stuff very well. And then other people aren't. And I'm in that category where it's taken me a long time to get to the point to where I can talk about my stuff in a way that I feel like works. But yeah, the marketing has helped, but probably not as much as it should.
Huh. That's what I was going to ask you about, how much you've carried over from your day job to market yourself. And I can definitely relate with the do as I say, but not as I do kind of. Yeah. I'll teach playwriting workshops sometimes, and I'll give advice about, or if I, same thing with like solo performance, I'll do a solo performance workshop and I'll give advice about like, here's how you could do this, or here's a way to do this. And then somebody sometimes will say, well, is that what you do? And I'm like, no, I don't do that, but you could do that. So,
well, a good example of this,
kind of the ups and the downs of that. Yeah, go ahead for yourself.
Yeah, I was going to say a good example is we oftentimes teach our clients that they don't need to spread themselves thin. Like find a few avenues to kind of promote your stuff, whether it be email, Facebook, Instagram. You don't need to be on all the things and really learn how to kind of focus your efforts and to find your audience. And that's a thing that I think as creatives, we get pulled into like, I want to do TikTok and I want to be on Twitter and I'm going to do some of this and do some of that. And you end up spreading yourself thin, even though we tell our clients not to do that. I find that a lot of writers in particular will be on like 5 or 6 different social media platforms when really they only need to be on like maybe 1 or 2. The other thing is that whole idea of defining your audience, like finding your target audience. I mean, I've been working on the Dryad's Crown for 2 years now, and maybe even a little bit longer than that. I would say it was about last month that I really figured out who my key audience is as far as demographics go, like who is my ideal reader. And that's a wonderful exercise and tremendously helpful. But it took me a long time of writing to figure out, okay, when I send stuff out, who are the most enthusiastic readers, responders? Who are the people that are like, I'm like, oh, this person is way into it. And I find that, not surprising, my target audience is women. Women read my stuff more than men do. And they tend to be millennial age. These are the people that were at the bookstore at midnight for the Harry Potter releases. They read Aragon. They read Twilight. They are voracious readers. Weirdly enough, they're dog owners. Like, I don't know what it is, but the people who own dogs are like way into my stuff. Which, here's something funny. Book 9, I put a dog in the story. And it was like, oh, because I know I have people who love dogs, I need to have a dog in here somewhere. And so it's really funny because, yeah, like there's one character who gets a dog. And my wife, when she was reading it, she was like, I actually think, like, because her story was kind of up in the air. And she's like, I actually don't think she needs to, like, get this much resolution. Like, she's got her dog. She's living her life. Like, she's good. Like, I was like, oh yeah, the girl's got a dog. Who needs love and fulfillment, mission? Like, she's got a dog. She's good.
But like, dog, she's taken care of.
Yeah, we don't need anything else. But these are also people who they love going to Half Price Books. They love going to Barnes & Noble. They love their libraries. They lean liberal. They'll post about political issues that concern them. And yeah, I just learned all this stuff about them. And I was like, okay, this is helpful now, because now when I see someone online, I'm like, yes, this is the person that I can really target with my stuff. Even with social media, you can now create ads that really target people and go, okay, the person who likes my stuff also reads this stuff. And not to turn this around and make it about you, but I think that this is one of the most challenging areas of theater, because I don't know if there are people who are like, I really like this one playwright and I only go see plays by people who are like, it seems like people who are into the theater are just theater people. And yeah, I might be wrong about that, but
you're not. It's hard to, as segment. You're describing, two things stick out. One thing is, as you're describing your ideal reader, I was like, oh, David, you're describing yourself. I mean, I don't know if you own a dog, but
I do.
Other than that, like, I was like, that sounds like you. Like, you seem like the person that likes to go to Half Price Books. You seem like the person that would stand in line to meet, you know, your favorite writer.
My ideal reader is younger than me, though.
Oh, true, true. I don't know who I have for years tried to figure out who my audience is, and I cannot narrow it. As soon as I think I know it, I am wrong, or I am way off base. And it's happened to me over and over again. And it's not impossible, but it's difficult in a live experience setting to get the metrics on that, to actually take a survey and have people actually fill it out and get the feedback on that. So a lot of it has been anecdotal instead of like actual data. So for years I have been trying to figure out who, and as far as like the non-live experience, so I have a bunch of plays on Amazon that as I was talking about earlier, that I've self-published, but I don't know who reads those plays. I don't read unless I'm very interested in a playwright, because I want to learn how to play, to write plays.
Yeah.
I don't read plays for entertainment. I see plays for entertainment. I don't read them unless I'm studying them. And I always wonder about that. Like the particular art form that I practice is in some ways hard to digitalize. It is hard to gather hard feedback on without coming face to face with the people. So yeah, I envy that a little bit. For other artists. But yeah, it's just the nature of the beast. And also it has the curse of locality. Mm-hmm. Like, I either have to take my productions to audiences in far off places, or I am relegated to the people that will drive, say, up to half an hour maybe to see one of my shows after that. So there's only a finite number of people, and in that number of people, there's only a finite. I feel like Blockbuster compared to like the age of Netflix, but that it is as it is, and I'm gonna keep working on it. But that's one of the reasons I've got you here in the podcast, because I'm in, like, suddenly like picking your brain underneath the surface here. Because for instance, you just mentioned like you put targeted ads. Do you mean like Facebook ads? Do you do like Boost or whatever you promote? I don't know what the word is for like Instagram posts or like what do you mean when you say targeting social media ads?
Yeah, with and I would recommend Facebook and Instagram. I think that Twitter's ad, it needs work. But with Facebook in particular, and even Instagram, because they're kind of all connected, you can create a profile and say, all right, I want to send this ad out, and it's only going to hit women ages this to this. And you can even be things who say in their profile that they like theater, you know. And so for you, you would also geo-target it, where you'd go, okay, people in Dallas or people within 30 miles of Arlington or whatever it is. Like you can kind of figure out, okay, I know that most people will drive only this far to go to a play, and the play is going to be in Fort Worth. And so I know that this is kind of my group here. And then Facebook will try its darndest to send the ads only to those people. And you learn things from that. I mean, one of the things that's really helpful for me is, I mean, you are kind of, you know, you're locked with your geography. I mean, I get people buying my book from all over the place. And what it does is, and I've given out a lot of copies of my book as well. And, you know, you email lots of people, and eventually you do start seeing trends. And so that's when I start noticing, oh, people in a particular segment really seem to like my books. The people who like this, who do this, who, you know, and then you start putting together a profile. Now, I broke one of the cardinal rules, which is you don't ever share that profile with people. You keep it secret. You don't want people to know. But you know, I figure we're talking shop here, so it's fine. Because the truth is, anyone who wants to read my book is more than welcome to have at it. But you also begin to realize, oh, there is a type of person who, instead of staying up late watching a movie, will like binge watch Dragon Prince on Netflix, and they really also seem to like my book. You know,
it's funny that the Facebook ad thing, I have started doing that for fringe festivals.
Yeah,
because nobody, well, it's arguable that people know me in my own hometown, but when I go out of town to a fringe festival, I know that they don't know who I am. Like I am not a name commodity, and I'm firmly convinced that my audiences don't know that they're going to like my stuff until they see my stuff.
Yeah.
And the hard part of that is that without knowing the stuff, they still have to see it. Like getting them to see it. I'm like, you're going to have fun at the theater if I can get you in the theater. It's like I've gotten past the mechanics of making good stuff, which was a hurdle, like a long years and years, like you were talking about. You're like under the ice, under the surface of the water. The bulk of the iceberg is you writing lots of essays, lots of articles, comic books, you know, other fiction before you even got to this part. Once I can get them in the door, but I've started doing Facebook ads in cities where I've gone, that I'm going to. And I just started actually the last couple of times, and I found them pretty beneficial. People don't walk up afterwards and go, I saw your Facebook ad and that's why I'm here. But I think if they see me a couple of times, then the Facebook ad and then local paper, and like it adds up. It doesn't seem to hurt, and I don't feel that I'm losing money on it so far. I did have a question though. Do you put together, when you do your ads, do you just do visual ads, or do you do little I don't know if you have any book trailers. I didn't actually research that. Do you have any like videos or something besides like your YouTube videos? Like,
yeah, I don't have any like actual like book trailers. I know it's a thing that people like in the industry will do. I have found though that it's a lot of work that I don't know if it gets, I don't know if it gets clicks. Like, I don't know if it really is worth the time. And, because I can put together just a graphic where it's like, here's the book and here's like a sentence or two about it. And people will be like, ooh, I would like that. And they'll click it and they'll download it. But if I create this like video, I don't know. It's sort of it's the rule of the roses. If you give your wife 12 dozen or yeah, like 12 roses, that's 1 point. If you give her one rose, that's still 1 point. Like the gesture is 1 point. However much you heap onto it isn't going to like get you any extra. So it's like, if I do a good ad, that's 1 point. If I do this really amazing book trailer, that's still just 1 point. Like I don't get the same return on it.
I see. I asked this because I actually got the idea for the Facebook ads in different cities from a musician, a friend of mine, who I was just chit-chatting with. And I'm like, when you play gigs out of town, how do you get audiences? And he's like, Facebook ads. And I was like, really? And I was like, well, why didn't I think of that like before? Like, it took me years.
Yeah. One, because of that, just the geo-targeting. I mean, it's so huge.
So let's touch real quick here. Give me the blurb, I guess, for Dryad's Crown. How would you describe it if you were meeting somebody and they said, hey, what's your book about?
Yeah, I would say that it is a story of a magical creature from the forest who, through a series of twists and turns, ends up being raised in the city. And fate has other plans for her and kind of leads her on this journey of discovery and ultimately back to the forest she came from. So, you know, it's magical, mysterious, wondrous, but all of it is very much rooted in human emotion and human experience. I'll tighten it up a little bit more once I start going to conventions. I used to joke that I could describe my story in 3 words, which is Faye gone astray. That's it. Like, yeah. But that doesn't really move the needle as the expression goes. But yeah, it's an epic fantasy story about a wood nymph that finds herself far from the forest she grew up in, living in the city and falling into the hands of a cruel, wicked stepmother-esque woman that creates this long shadow over her life. And yeah, it's a story of love and life and loss and all of that.
Silbury, the character's name is Silbury, right? Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah.
And the world you're creating is Efrey Usel? Did I say it right?
Yeah, Efrey Usel.
Efrey Usel. Your books read pretty fast, by the way. Like, they're... What are they on the page? Like 60 to 80 pages or something? Like they're novella length.
Yeah, has been really encouraging. Is I have found that people have not found, like people have been able to plow through them pretty quickly. I found that they are immensely bingeable, which is good.
Yeah, I've noticed. I looked up some of them on Goodreads, and you have a couple of reviews of people that have followed along installment by installment. The same reviewers, like the same people. They're like, I'm waiting for the next one. I finished this one. I'm waiting for the next one.
Yeah.
both in a like, hooray for you, David Hopkins. And also like, curse you, David Hopkins. Yeah. Cliffhangers.
Yeah. Book 4 is the real, that's where I get really mean. I think I have like 3 different cliffhangers in book 4. It's like, so. 5 is out. You can just go right from one to the other.
You just mentioned that the audiobook is in the works. What else is on the horizon? What else? Give me the timeline again.
The Dryad's Crown?
Yeah. So you've got the other books coming out in the spring. Yes. The novellas. And then when you say you're going to release the full volume in September, are you making a decorative hardback? Is it? It's all being released and then like all the stuff around it, I guess, like the audiobook and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So starting in February 2nd, I'm releasing book 7, which is A Still Voice Beyond the Shallows. They're really long, pretentious titles. And then 8 is A Winding Path to Aldebaran, and that's going to be released like 3 weeks later. And then 3 weeks after that will be the final book 9, which is A New Soil Upon Aemon, which wraps up the story. But then what I've essentially done is I'm going to take those 9 books and I'm going to kind of read through it all, and I'm not going to change anything too significantly, but there may be some scenes that get added or tweaked here and there. And I'll do another proofread through it, and then we'll kind of, you know, just to make it flow more as a single work. And then we'll have a paperback. I'm not going to do a hardcover for it. I know a lot of people really love hardcovers, but the margins on those are so small that I think it would be better for me to wait and maybe like a few years from now do like a special edition of hardcovers for people who are sort of the super fans, and maybe give them something that's a really quality. I mean, I'm not committing to it yet, but if I were to do a hardcover, it would be a nice quality piece that would just look really great on their shelf. And it would include more books that they could kind of throw in there. So yeah, I'll do a paperback, and the cover's already ready for that. And it looks wonderful. And then I think in April, I'm handing off the manuscript to Lindsay, and she's going to do the audiobook. And so hopefully the audiobook and the paperback will launch on the same day. So September 6th, you could get the audiobook or you could get the paperback. And then while I'm kind of in that getting the book ready zone, I'm also writing a prequel called War of the Hounds, which relates to some of the big historical events that were happening right when Silbri was born. And it is, that is going to be a shorter book. It's, I think, maybe a little less than 200 pages. And that will come out probably in December of next year. And my hope for that is it's going to be a freebie that people can download if they sign up for my newsletter. So if you sign up for the newsletter, you can get that book. And so that's going to be the thing that I really want to, so people love the Dryad's Crown. They're like, oh, I want to read this story about what happened before that. You're going to have to join my newsletter, and then you can get the book. And then I may also have a paperback.
Have you started work on that, or is that on the horizon to start on?
That is, I've got a pretty good outline of it. The actual writing of it, I haven't done yet. So, but I can do 50,000 words probably over the course of about 4 months if I really hit it pretty hard. Like, if I'm focused, if I can do about 500 words a day, and then yeah, it kind of all works out. So it will be ambitious, but then after that, there will be the next book, which is The Summer Sword, which picks up where the Dryad's Crown ends, and it will be the next big book in the series. And then after that, there's a smaller book. So I'm going like big book, small book, called Barber and the Blade, which is a standalone story about one of the side characters that I really like. And then the third book, which I don't have a title for, will be sometime in like 2026 or whatever. So what I'm trying to do is just get on a once a year schedule. And that kind of is just the expectation of the genre. Like, fantasy readers expect their authors to release something about once a year. That's kind of the, you know, it's weird because, like, in the world of literary fiction, Juan O'Diez might write a Pulitzer Prize winning novel, and then you might not hear from him for 10 years.
Yeah.
And in the world of fantasy, they're like, oh, okay, this book was good. So what are you doing next year? And you're like, oh, okay.
Let me wipe the, funny thing is, the blood and the sweat from this one.
Yeah. Woo. Okay. Yeah. Let's do this. But the funny thing is, April, who I told you is not a fantasy reader, after she read all of The Dryad's Crown, she was like, so you're going to do more stories in this world? And I was like, yeah. She was like, why? And I was like, because that's the expectation. I was like, there's, you know, I've got my Wheel of Time series up on my bookshelf. There's like several volumes of it. And it's the same characters in the same world having amazing adventures. Like that's kind of the expectation of the genre. So it would be weird to write the Dryad's Crown and be like, okay, I'm done.
I'll try to make another world now.
Yeah. And create brand new. So yeah. So I'm trying to kind of let people know. I'm like, oh no. This is going to be a long, this could equal several years of my life. Like, telling more stories set in this world. And she's like, well, do you like it? I was like, oh, I love it. This is like these characters, the more I write them,
I hope so.
Yeah. I mean, I am so excited to tell some more of these stories, and I've got, you know, certain characters that I'm really excited to come back to, certain villains that I'm like, oh, need more of this guy. And so, yeah, it's a lot of fun, but it's also, you know, it's the genre. Like it's a weird thing because we don't think about that always. Actually, I would say nowadays we're probably doing more of that, where it's like you do a movie and then you're like, okay, well, now I want more movies with Iron Man. And you're like, but we already did an Iron Man movie. Well, yeah, but that was just one Iron Man movie. What about?
Yeah, no, you've made a sandbox. Yeah. Now playing it. Yeah.
Yeah. We need more. And so, you know, so much of the Dryad's Crown, that last part of the Dryad's Crown, in many ways is really just and here's what you will see in the future. Like it's just setting up, this is what future adventures might look like.
Oh, that's fantastic. Is this, yeah. No, I was going to ask, never mind. I'm going to not, cause I'm going to read your books. I was going to ask, is the Dryad's Crown going to feature Silbri and her family, or is she worked into the other works? I guess not the ones that predate her.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the War of the Hounds will feature some characters that were older in the Dryad's Crown, and we get to see them as they were younger. But Silbri, obviously, she's just a little bitty baby at that point, or a fish, if you've read the book at that point.
Yeah.
It's a great thing about fairy tales. You can really do anything. But I will say that I'm kind of taking a sort of an epic approach to it, where there are certain authors who will tell a story where it's a multi-generational story.
Yeah.
And so future books will be about her family. It may or may not have more of her in it, but it definitely will have more of her family in it, because now we'll see other characters who've gotten older and they've gotten relationships and they've met people. And so, you know, I like that kind of genre where it's like, I've read this thing and now I know about the grandfather and several generations of this family and kind of where they've gone through all of this.
Huh. I have to say, I really like the character of Silbri a lot. She's both sympathetic. Like I want to follow her,
yeah.
But she's definitely not a saint.
No.
Very well-rounded character. Very well-rounded. And I have enjoyed seeing the different aspects of her just in the first book and seeing her, you know, growing up and then becoming a mother and like these kind of things. Like very well-rounded.
Oh, thank you. Well, and I think one of the things that helps you create well-rounded characters is that you start looking at certain cliches within literature and you go, well, what if it wasn't that way? And so, for instance, we always kind of operate with the default assumption that mothers love being mothers and all mothers like are just naturally. And it's not that Silbri doesn't hate her children. Silbri loves her children, but she doesn't know what to do. It's not like she was just, the children came into the world and she automatically knew how to be a mom. And that's not her, because that wasn't how she was raised. And so that becomes like really the thing that drives her character is in many ways attacking the cliche, which is that moms just all know how to mom.
Right.
And she's like, I don't, you got me. Like she's not, that's not her. In fact, the person who is probably the most nurturing in her family was her husband, and he doesn't last long in the story. Yeah, so, you know, yeah. And so that becomes, you know, and I'm sure you're the same way. It's like you take a character and then you put them in situations where it's like, oh, now their weaknesses and their strengths become more obvious because they're having to make choices and they don't always make great choices and on and on and on. The funny thing is we had mentioned that I almost became a pastor. You'll be surprised to know that the balded, bearding, portly priest figure is vaguely based on myself. So, like
the Timon character?
Yeah, Timon.
Timon. Okay.
Yeah, like Lion King, Timon. But yeah, it is one of these things where
I thought it was the reference to the Shakespeare play.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. No, I was thinking Lion King. it's a good name. Either way. But like but yeah, if you want, I mean, there's a little bit of me in all of the characters, but this sort of priestly pastoral figure, that was something that I was like, okay, every time in fantasy you see like religious figures, they're always like these evil, like pseudo Catholic type figures. Like they're always corrupt. And I'm like, what if you were to create a pastor figure who actually was not a complete like like narcissist? I don't know. Like I just the evil priest is I think a cliche that needs to be done away with. So I wanted to create a character who was a little bit kinder and gentler. And he's been a really fun character to write. But
no, he's fun to read too. He's very he's casually caring is what I would say.
Yeah, and that was a situation where it was like, oh, how do we attack the stereotype, you know?
Well, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Well, hey man, I wish you the best with it, and
so much.
I'll be following along on your greater journey, you know, as an artist and as a writer, and I'll definitely put links to all your stuff in the show notes.
Well, thank you.
Your website is probably the best place to.
I think so, because from the website you can get to everything else.
Okay, I'll put a link to it in the show notes, and people can check you out. I recommend everyone does check you out, and if people are listening and they're fantasy readers, then definitely check you out.
Especially if they like dogs, yeah.
If they like dogs, I mean, they may have to wait to the ninth part of it, but there's a dog.
There's a dog.
So
worth it.
But hey, I appreciate you jumping on with me, and I know we've rambled for a while. It's been fun. It's been fun to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. Likewise.
Well, have a good 2023, man.
And you as well.
And until next time, take it easy.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
All right. That sums it up. I really appreciate you listening to the Cultivated Playwright podcast. If you want any information from this episode, I'll put it all in the show notes on the website, which is cultivatedplaywright.wordpress.com. Also, you can find out information about me, Brad McIntyre, at bradmcintyre.com. I should announce that I have just released an ebook of my children's picture book, Petey Gale Goes Up and Beyond, which is available on Amazon. Also, a paperback edition of a collection of holiday plays called The Yeti in the Airport Lounge. And that is also available on Amazon.com. I will put links to those on the show notes. And also you can visit my website or just search me out on Amazon. Anyway, big thanks to David Hopkins for sitting down to talk with me. He's an awfully good sport, and I recommend highly that you support his work. And just like the previous episode, I'll put his information in the show notes as well. I believe his website is thatdavidhopkins.com. because there's other David Hopkins on the internet. So he's thatdavidhopkins, all one word, .com. Anyway, thanks so much for listening, and I really appreciate your support. And have a wonderful day. Until the next time.